All right, now it's on.
All right, so we'll call to order the regular meeting of the North Bend Planning Commission for Thursday, April 14th, 2016. First item is to approve the agenda for this tonight's meeting. Do I have a motion to approve the agenda?
I'll second the motion.
Okay, so a motion by Mr. Lucky and a second by Mr. Ryan. Any changes? All those in favor of tonight's agenda, say aye.
Aye.
The motion passes unanimously. Next item is approval of minutes for the March 24th, 2016 meeting. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Okay, a motion by Mr. Lucky and a second by Mr. Von Trapp. Any changes or comments?
I was just curious because I wasn't at the meeting. We may talk about it later, but if the century
Century
comments were just addressed and everything.
Yes, yeah, we'll go into that in the agenda.
Okay.
I'd just like to thank staff or whoever's doing the minutes that appreciated the level of detail.
Tom puts those together.
Thank you, Tom.
What's that?
I was just thanking Tom for the level of detail on the minutes.
What level of detail?
That he put in.
He stepped it up a notch.
Yeah.
Did I get the same as you guys got? You want even more detail.
Any other comments? All those in favor of approving the minutes for March 24, 2016, say aye.
Aye.
The minutes are approved unanimously. Public comment on non-agenda items. Seeing no one from the public present, we will move on then to item number four, which is Planning Commission deliberation and possible recommendation on amendments to North Bend Municipal Code Chapters 12.08, 19.06, and 19.07 pertaining to installation of franchise utility facilities and streetlights.
It's a mouthful.
It is.
Three times fast.
Yeah.
Mike, are there any updates or things that you wish to inform us about since
we
last met?
Yeah, just picking up from the last time that we met, you recall that we had just received comment letters from CenturyLink and from Puget Sound Energy, and we wanted more time to be able to digest those and have our city attorney review those. Our city attorney did review those, and the primary concern that was raised in the CenturyLink letter was it seemed like they felt that that what the city was asking was for all franchise utilities or all overhead lines be undergrounded. And I think they were concerned that that meant just everything. And we wanted to clarify in our regulations to alleviate those concerns that we're just talking about when something's touched by development, when new development or redevelopment is occurring, that's where that particular frontage of the property is required to underground the lines, not wholesale throughout the city, big program. So we addressed that with some comments in there. They had some other comments about legality, and they cited some WACC. We had our legal team review that, and our legal team disagreed with their analysis. So
what analysis was that?
About the ability to require undergrounding. The CenturyLink letter cited the rights that utility providers have, and they were saying that we cannot require undergrounding.
They also said the state requires overhead or above ground poles, with a few exceptions too. They said that the state, being the licensor of their license, calls for overhead poles.
It authorizes overhead poles, but what our city attorney confirmed was that cities have broad authority to require undergrounding, and you see that very frequently. Most cities these days require undergrounding in different circumstances.
I didn't get the impression, though, I'm debating you on this, because I didn't get the impression that they answered city lights charge. They said that we're allowed to overhead poles according to state law. Now, where did you guys refute that? I didn't see you guys.
I didn't provide the attorney letter to you guys. I provided the amendments that were suggested by the attorney. I don't know that an attorney's letter to staff is typically provided in the record.
Okay, well, I just didn't see that their concern was met with an objective comment. He just almost dismissed it.
we don't necessarily have to provide a comment letter back to the commenter, but we acknowledge that we've received the comments and have considered them and addressed them.
But I may weigh on my vote tonight. I'm saying that I was expecting, since they submitted a letter and you responded to it, you should have responded, but they should have responded back to the, to what they said, the state allows us to put overhead poles, except where there's requirements for an underground pole. They seem to think they have a right to put it above ground unless there's a real specific reason to go underground. And they aren't saying that's a matter of safety. They don't agree with you on that. I'm just reading it back what they're saying. Mm-hmm. So I thought we'd have some comment back that would be a legal opinion about why we're not going to agree with them.
So you're just saying we're not formally acknowledging their letter other than the fact that we have it.
Yeah. And that's typical. It would take an enormous amount of staff time to respond to each and every comment letter that comes in.
And to negotiate, right? I mean, mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about setting up.
My concern, too, would be that having responded back would turn it into a legal situation when there's not actually a triggering event to make it one. So they provided information that says the state says we're allowed to do this. We're saying that the choice is the city wants you to underground. We don't actually have something that's creating a point where we really need to be debating that.
We're not in conflict with the law.
Exactly. We're not in conflict with the law. So by responding to them, you almost create a situation that doesn't exist because you're beginning to debate a legal point when we don't have a development or an action toward them requiring them to underground for a specific purpose that would actually start that conversation. Does that make sense?
It's a bit like the courtroom question, Joe, if you don't mind, where the attorney asked the accused, at what point did they stop beating their husband? Well, how the hell do you answer that question? So that's what they've done, is state their case, right? So we don't need to, can't really, because our attorney's not going to have the authority to tell them what the reality is, because it hasn't been decided. It's just our set of rules against what they're suggesting the state says.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go back, and Mike, do you want to continue on with your update, or is that pretty much?
I can continue on to provide the rest of the summary of updates that were made, and then we can go back and go through those.
Yeah, like. And then I'll ask for a motion. And
okay. Other things to address CenturyLink and Puget Sound Energy's concerns was about the 90-day time limit. That was a common time limit that I saw through a number of jurisdictions' codes, and that was already in our existing code, but Puget Sound Energy was concerned with that, and I believe CenturyLink was as well. So our attorney suggested some language that you see in there that provides some reasonableness language about unforeseen events or circumstances beyond the control of the franchisee. And then to address the Planning Commission's comments at the last meeting about the aesthetics of transmission lines, we've put in some language in there. We've kept it relatively broad, but talked about needing to meet with the city to consider pole height, spacing, color, et cetera, to address aesthetic concerns. And then finally, we put in some additional language about the color light temperature for streetlights, as the Planning Commission had suggested doing that. So I took a look at information on the International Dark Sky Association website, and then also talked with Puget Sound Energy and Tanner Electric about the dark sky information. They're kind of at the opposite ends. The Dark Sky Association wanted, I think it was like 3,000 some odd Kelvin for streetlights. Puget Sound Energy said many are installed up to 5,000 in different circumstances. 4,000 is becoming more typical. What I provided in here is not to exceed 4,000, which is a white light, not quite yellow, but not the very bluish white that you see in some of the earlier LED streetlights like were put in Seattle early on. That's going to be up to the Planning Commission. You can consider the materials that I provided in the packet, but I thought 4,000 was a good medium range temperature.
So just so I'm clear, the Kelvin conversation is a heat measurement, but LED is not.
Yeah, and
technically hot.
I don't know
it's
that
just the color of that level of heat is after trying to is that how it connects?
Yeah, I'm not a lighting expert, but that's how color temperature is measured as well.
The Kelvin scale came about with candlelight and then went into incandescent and fluoride.
And so that is it then.
Awesome.
Go back and go through.
So with that, I would like to entertain a motion to approve the amendments to our North Bend Municipal Code as stated. Is there anybody that would like to make a motion so we can begin talking about it?
As we say, so moved.
Okay, so Commissioner Von Trapp makes a motion to approve the amendments to North Bend Municipal Code Chapters 12.08, 19.06, and 19.07 pertaining to installation of franchise utility facilities and streetlights. Is there a second? And a second by Commissioner Lucky. So, at this point, any comments or changes that you'd like to make?
I think I didn't interrupt you earlier, did I? Let me cut you off.
I'm going to, since Eric Schwab, CenturyLink, in his comments stated with MICW, I'm not satisfied to come back and set us in and have reacted to that. I think that it's in a, ICW that the telecommunications companies have a right to erect holes for supporting the insulators, wires, and that necessary fixtures on other lines. That's probably not the complete language in that code.
Yeah, I think that was part of what our attorney looked at and stated that what they were citing was not in the full context of the law.
And so I would like to see that. I'm uncomfortable by hearing that just before we get. I'd like to see him say that.
If you want a recess, I can go back to the office and go get that letter.
I'd be more comfortable. I mean, I just feel like I'm uncomfortable with the way the Planning Commission is being asked just to accept things on their face. I think that this is a company, well, you know, a major company with very competent attorneys, and they come back with reasons why they're objecting to us what we're doing, and we don't seem to provide them with enough information, provide us with enough information to be satisfied with our response. I'm unsatisfied with the way we responded to this.
So
I can't support the motion until I feel more comfortable that we've actually have responded to them and have made a convincing argument.
I hear your point, and I thank you for your comments, and it sounds like you're not asking for a change. Is that correct, that you're just saying that you're not going to be in favor of this?
I don't feel comfortable voting in favor of this until I understand how we have successfully disputed their views.
Okay. So if it's information that you're seeking, we could take a 10-minute recess. I'll go print off a copy of the email that came from our attorney. I don't know about procedure on that, though. I don't think that it's typical for an attorney's advice to staff to be a part of the record.
Fine. You might have a majority of the vote here. I'm just saying I can't support this the way I can't support our response back to CenturyLink. I don't think it's sufficient.
Are you talking about communication to CenturyLink, or are you talking about communication to the Planning Commission?
I'm taking the argument of CenturyLink, where they cited this statute as the reason for objecting, and we have not come back to them and said clear enough so the commission will understand why we believe we can't. We're just saying we won't do it. We're not going to accept it. I just don't go along with that comment.
So,
support.
I don't know. I'm going to ask Mike to correct me if I'm wrong. From what I heard is that you told us verbally that there is state law, but it doesn't prohibit a municipality from adopting something
correct.
Different.
Yeah.
So hearing that, I don't think there is a conflict or a need for more proof, because I'm going to believe our staff representation here. If your level or burden is different, that's fine. You know, that's for each commissioner to feel comfortable with. I've been here and, you know, feel confident that they've taken that step and verified it.
We certainly do not want to put ourselves into a situation where we make our law unsound. So we consider our...
I agree that, Mike, and you wouldn't want that. I just think you have here. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
I think you have. I think you're asking the commissioners to take it off. That this law doesn't apply in this case. And so I'm going to have to go back and dig this up myself. I satisfy myself that I'm going to do that. And if that's what we have to do as commissioners here, then I'll start doing that. But I don't think we're responding clearly enough to refute their comment. That's all I'm saying. I'm not trying to be. I'm just trying to say that.
So for the discussion, is that me?
Everybody's like,
sorry.
Is that me? Is that
vibrating somewhere? So for the discussion, because it's an interesting topic, I think. So we've got one, if I'm reading this correctly, we've got one rather sophisticated entity who suggested that our code is going to be, I don't think they've actually said illegal, but they've said against, conflict with, they've used those terms. And then, I'm not an attorney, but I read this and think, okay, this guy's just pulled out a quote from the RCW, and he puts it in quotes. There's some comment in the RCW that reads, erect poles for supporting the insulation wires and necessary features of the lines. I'm sure that's in there somewhere in the code, but it's not an inalienable right to put them up whenever they want. So we're coming back as a city saying, you know, we really don't like the poles, so whenever possible, we're going to require that you put them underground. So that's kind of how I interpret. I totally get why they would write this letter, because it's cheaper and easier to put up poles. They want to defend the right to put up poles. But I'm not concerned that this is anything more than their attorney trying to...
The much more frequent circumstance also of having overhead poles would be Puget Sound Energy with electrical. This is just CenturyLink with their... well, I guess they probably have quite a bit, too, with telephone. But Puget Sound Energy didn't object at all to undergrounding requirements. So they're going to be probably just as familiar, if not more familiar, with state law than the attorney from Louisiana or wherever it was from CenturyLink.
They also said they think that the underground utilities, there would not be a perfected easement to do that. They have an easement, perfected easement above ground. They'll perfect the easement below ground. With that somewhere in their comments.
It's within the public right of way, so
yeah.
We wouldn't be requiring them to seek new easements across. This isn't transmission lines, these are just distribution lines which are within the public right of way.
Yeah.
I guess a clarification link is, did CenturyLink, kind of read the code wrong, where they say all new and existing?
Yeah, that's part of what we provided some additional language to clarify. So we're just talking about when we've got development or redevelopment occurring on a property, that's where the development then is responsible to underground those lines.
So have they seen that response?
CenturyLink?
Yeah.
No, but we have provided the edits. So again, it would not be feasible for us to respond to every comment letter that's received. It just would be overwhelming to staff time.
Yeah. So was there any response at all to this letter, either any kind of communication back the other way when we got this letter from CenturyLink?
No.
Okay. Just our own internal review of what they suggest.
Hmm.
Gotcha.
Which is standard for public comment,
yeah.
Whether it come from a corporation, a lobby company, or individuals.
Right. Hmm. I believe it may be the case when lines are underground that cost goes to maybe the developer.
Correct.
In that case. Okay.
Yeah.
That's why I think PSC, for example, didn't say anything because they're not going to pay for it. So if you want to go for it, you're going to pay for it. So someone is, but not them.
Hmm.
call a question.
No.
Oh.
Sorry. So, we'll rule, because there's more discussion, I'm sure. So I didn't establish any way that we're reviewing this, and I kind of left it out for everybody to voice up and go through this, but just anything on page one of the edits, the franchise utilities relocation, section 19.06020 under purpose? No? Hearing none, going to page two. Any comments or changes there?
Just part of the discussion in the motion?
Yes. I'm just looking to see if anybody has any changes, just so we can kind of go in a logical way until where I get where I have a point.
Okay. Just leading up to something.
Yes. Okay, page three. That's where I see the relocation time limit, which has been updated. And I noticed this text that was struck is below.
Yeah, that was kind of an odd placement there. That was just from the existing code, and it related to cable television conduits. So we cut that out and put the equivalent up above it under cable television, or undergrounding overhead existing utilities. So you see just at the top of the page there. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the next section is 19.06080, which is a new section on electrical transmission facilities. Should that be facilities or overhead lines? I don't know what facilities in detail means, but I'm thinking this is specifically about the existing overhead lines or transmission lines. And if those are the ones that will be remaining above ground, just maybe make it specific to.
I had that question too, and there is a definitions section. On page two, take a look and see if that helps.
How old is the structure?
1906040.
We could put in just in the title there, overhead electrical transmission facilities, just for clarification.
Yeah, I think it should be specific to the overhead.
Okay.
Just so we're being clear about what we're not saying anything but the overhead ones there. Mm-hmm. And then I guess my only thought on that is if we're protecting the view, but we have to wipe out a grove of trees to do so, is that a staff decision, or do we need some more language here that just makes the best, I guess, interest of our community? So I'm just trying to think outside the box or think this through. I like the idea. I wanted the idea in there to protect views, and being that we're focused on tourism, we ought not to have, you know, or maybe we direct the Parks Department to have some points that are like viewing points for people to come, and that's where we focus, not having transmission lines intersect, or we purposely plan them out so we can accommodate the transmission lines where they are existing. So those are my thoughts. I don't know what the Planning Commission feels. They like it as is. Nothing's more needed.
I don't know. I kind of read the sentence, I guess the second sentence of that 19.06080 as indicating like it's going to be a case-by-case basis. We're going to talk about it, and hopefully we're going to give them benefit of the doubt that those things would be discussed. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and Peter's Energy also responded to this, saying they were concerned about providing any specific criteria for just that reason, that mm-hmm. each context of a franchise or a transmission facility is going to be different. And
yeah.
So it's better to just have it as a come and meet and consult, and we'll figure out the best strategies.
Because I agree. I mean, we don't want some 80-year-old, you know, grove of 80-year-old Doug firs getting wiped out.
Or on the other side of that, we put them there where they're all diseased and they end up falling over and knocking out power for half the city. So, you know.
He's back
in. Yeah. I like the way it is. Okay.
It sounded like there's a Middle Fork substation that Tanner Electric's putting up.
Yes.
Is that going to need to be under review or anything? Or is that,
under review. Yeah, they submitted that.
You talked about that last week, or last meeting.
Yeah.
He was here.
They haven't yet submitted for the line upgrade, though. So if this is adopted for the line upgrade, this will apply to that.
All right. Anything else on page 3? Moving on to page 4, street lighting. So the biggest edit we have is to provide the warmer lighting tones that reduce glare and night sky pollution. Fixtures shall provide a correlated light color temperature not to exceed 4,000 Kelvin. How familiar are we with what that looks like? I wanted an example. Well, I have an LED light for my video camera. If the Planning Commission would permit me, I'd be happy to shine it on any surface so we could understand 3,000 to 5,000 Kelvin. That way you might be able to know if 4,000 is the right mix.
I like demonstrations.
It's small, it's not big. Okay. So it does have a diffuser which pops off and it's light. So you do not want to look directly at this. For a period of time.
To give so he's the one who's going to erase my memory.
Okay.
So do you know what the temperature rating on that is?
I know two temperatures, the minimum and maximum. The minimum, which is, let me try and get...
should we turn the lights out and get some popcorn?
Yeah, you can. So this is at the lowest setting, which is 3,200 Kelvin. Okay. And then just to go all the way up, the maximum is 5,600 Kelvin.
Oh, good examples.
Okay. So, you know, you guys can see, I'll go back now all the way down. So you can kind of understand light glare or light spread.
So do you
so
have...
So you got to weigh safety. If I go in the middle of both of those...
Is that 3,500?
No, that's in the middle of 32 and 56. So maybe closer to the 4,000.
So that would be a good representation of the color that we see, but not necessarily, what would you say, the brightness or the area that's covered, kind of?
The Kelvin doesn't address brightness. Right. It just addresses the color.
And right now, I think that our suggested language is not to exceed 4,000. Mm-hmm. Which is, we're gonna have this cut off.
Full cut off, yeah.
Yeah, which is another great feature. Yeah, it's a good demonstration.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, well done. So we really don't care if there's a cut off, right? You can be burning ants on the pavement, but you can't destroy the sky.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So, 4,000 color temperature. Planning Commission. Any thoughts?
That demonstration, I think it's something we can picture now.
So. I think, you know, when you look at it, it's not just the temperature, it's the glare that comes with the higher temperature. So I think 4,000 is white enough but and intense enough, but not too radiant.
When you have very light blue eyes, that even 4,000 is a problem.
Yeah. Well, it's a good consideration. We have a lot of Norwegian.
No, there are some cities where they're very bright. I have done that.
Yeah, city of Seattle. The Jeremy Michael from Puget Sound Energy said most of their earlier streetlights were at 5,000 Kelvin, mm-hmm. and that's where a lot of complaints came in, and that's where they started toning down to the 4,000.
So anyway, that's an LED light, so it should mimic that color pretty closely.
I think, yeah, that helps for me, but after kind of reading some of the literature, I recommend we go to 3,000, mainly because of where we are in this area, and we're right on the edge of National Forest, DNR, all kind, you know, so we're different than Kirkland or something like that. You know, go 4,000, definitely. I think that we've already discussed we'd like to separate ourselves from the rest of Western Washington. And I think this would be just another way to do it. And, you know, of course, there's safety. Is it going to be bright enough? You know, and those kinds of things. And, but a lot of communities have already done 3,000. That's what the dark sky recommends. That's what we want here is dark sky. You know, I don't have a whole lot of specific data to back it up, but what I've just, what I've read, looking at 3,000, I agree.
So what would you say about 4,000 at intersections and 3,000 once neighborhood streets?
I think as I read, that's what PSC does, 3,000 in neighborhoods, 4,000 on the streets. I don't agree with that as a whole. Maybe in some certain areas that maybe were very necessary, major intersections or something, but not as, especially at least limiting it in the subdivisions as the North Bend gets built out to 3,000, I think is very important. But some of these other areas can produce a lot of light. Maybe the, I don't know what the outlet mall looks at it, like at night if they shut those lights off, or, but just any of those kinds of areas, the little Safeway and the mini marts and stuff over there. Just thinking of those areas, and as the town grows, there'll be more of little areas like that. And when the area by the 76 station is built out, just those parking lots. You know, that's what kind of worries me.
You know, I'm still seeing now, and I've seen it more and more and longer, but there's a category of drivers that just think they can be seen no matter what kind of light there is, and they're not saving time. It's not honest. And at 6 o'clock, the sky is bright, but it's not light. And guys are driving around with no headlights on it because they can see the road, but I can't see them coming at me. And if we had, you know, like you're saying, on major right-of-ways like North Bend Way, 4,000 on those lights, so that illuminate North Bend Way, that'd be a lot safer because I can't see these guys coming at me until they're right at me. They think I can because they can see the road, but they're almost invisible. And so I think they need to be lighted up. But going down Tanner Road, yeah, 3,000, if that much.
Just a point of clarification that the Kelvin, again, is not a measurement of brightness. It's just color. So, for example, the sodium vapor streetlights that we have here right now are bright. But they're, I don't have the scale in front of me, it's in one of the notes. They're probably down in maybe the 2700, or no, they're at 2200 Kelvin. So they're still bright, but they're a much more reddish tone. So brightness could still be achieved with 3000 Kelvin, it's just not as efficient.
It's almost like there's a level of expertise in this lighting. We're talking about cars and streets. I think we've probably all been in towns where the street light is in the distance, but there's an intersection with, what's the term I'm trying to think of? Not directional, but the control, the traffic light. Mm-hmm. And you see the street light beyond the traffic light because it's a different color or something, and all of a sudden, particularly in a strange place, you're watching the street lights down the road instead of the one you're about to drive through. That sort of thing. And I question that came up as we were talking was, to me, the most notorious lights in town are the ones near the QFC. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do we know what those are?
In terms of Kelvin, those are probably the... they don't have it in here. They may be the metal halide, which is 5,500.
Because you can literally sit or stand 2 in the morning, choose and read by those lights. And I don't think that's, I'm pretty sure that's not what everybody wants throughout the city. Because we aren't downtown Seattle and don't need that much visibility.
There's a safety issue, I think, mm-hmm. at that
right.
type
yeah.
of business you do on Broadway.
Yeah. No, that's just on, that's actually not in the parking lot, yeah. That's on the street side mm-hmm. along mm-hmm. the new walkway. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you go, it was one of our first. You know, we kind of went down the streetscape trying to redirect. It's a cool idea. And the only thing wrong with any of that is the streetlights. Mm-hmm. Everything else is awesome.
Yeah. That's why we've looked to do, when it's beyond the downtown core right here, to match existing, that's where we want to go to the full cutoff fixture that you see in front of Bartels. So, right. We had a lot of very concerned residents that lived across the street from Bartels that were concerned about glare. Yeah. And we didn't get any complaints from them afterwards when those streetlights were installed.
Yeah. Well, Mike, I noticed that there are no changes to the foot candles at the ground level that we have, the arterial, collector, local access, or half street. And that's on page 5 for the Planning Commission. So if we're thinking about brightness, I'm sure those are either minimums or above minimum standards.
Those are minimums, and those are also in excess of what it currently is for the arterial street. So you'll recall red lines are only provided for each Planning Commission meeting, so you see what's changed since the last meeting. But the arterial standard is 0.6. Currently, our regulations only call out 0.4 for streets.
Okay. So, Dave, does that help to know that it's actually going to be brighter?
Yeah.
So, any other thoughts on Scott's proposal for 3,000 color temperature?
Scott, I liked how you laid it out there, and it made me think of sitting in my backyard, and you know, certain nights are better than others, and I don't, regardless of how long I've lived there, I wouldn't want that to change, or the number of those nights to become diminished as we build out, and if that is the dark sky recommendation, I would support that as well, especially in the residential area. I mean, Dick, I hear what you're saying, and I think we can address that through the brightness, but not necessarily the Kelvin, or as well as the Kelvins. But certainly, I mean, I got a new multi development right next to me, and I don't want to lose my night enjoyment because of that.
Mike, important consideration. Sorry. On his point, I don't know the street name where the multi development empties out onto that street.
Fork.
So, Fourth in that new intersection, would that be classified as a collector requirement?
No, that's the neighborhood.
Okay.
Local street.
So I'm just wondering then, the foot candles, you know, that if they're full cutoff fixtures, why we're not going for brighter down below? As you said, if we burn the ants.
Well, there could be a mirror parked car underneath the ant-burning device, which would project light into the bedroom of your grandmother's house.
Not at the intersection. It wouldn't be parked.
So full cutoff doesn't diminish the brightness at all. It just keeps it from angling.
Right. I'm just saying, so we're going to have full cutoffs. Why don't we make it a little bit brighter down below because we won't have to worry about the glare? Why don't we make that more intense? It, you know, we're talking about intersections, and we have a concern. We think about our population and what can we do to address just that as a safety standpoint, I guess, make them a little bit brighter.
From what I've seen, our consultant is working again on the public work standards, and that's where some of the early review of this came from. 0.4 is a standard brightness lumen for residential areas. So 0.6 might be too bright.
So I would guess then, as you get brighter, you're going to have more spread.
Okay. And when we say standard, you're saying standard across
common to jurisdictions. Yeah.
Okay. So we're talking about more urbanized areas as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the thought is 3,000 Kelvin.
3,000 Kelvin within neighborhoods and 4,000 along the streets or general public streets. Is that the
I would move for everywhere. And you have the brightness addressed already.
Okay.
I don't know. Up for discussion?
Any more discussion, or do we want to put it to a vote?
So to come back to that, it would end up being a friendly amendment here, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So with 3,000, if we use that language as opposed to the other references, doesn't it still leave the other regulations available for the amount of brightness?
Yes.
We're choosing a color with that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else, intersections versus, you know, next to their house in the neighborhood, that's a brightness conversation.
Right.
And that's, we covered that with the
foot candles. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so all those in favor of changing 4,000 Kelvin to 3,000 Kelvin, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is unanimous. So we are then looking for 3,000 Kelvin. On point D of section 19.06.110, street lighting. Good discussion, guys. Any other changes for this section? Okay, so again, the motion before you is to approve the amended North Bend Municipal Code Chapters 12.08, 19.06, and 19.07 pertaining to installation of franchise utility facilities and streetlights. Any final comments? All those in favor of the changes, say aye. Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. All right. Next thing on our agenda is the Planning Commission continued deliberation on the amendments to North Bend Municipal Code 18.40 bulk and dimensional standards concerning minimum lot size in the constrained low-density residential zone. Mike.
I introduced this at your last meeting tonight. We just want to have your deliberation, and we'll be scheduling a public hearing at your next meeting to take public comment on this. So again, just to summarize, this is direction from the council that when the constrained low-density residential zone was created, the amendments provided that the lot size was the same as the low-density residential zone in terms of minimum lot size, although the overall density was 2 units per acre rather than 4. So what that allowed for was clustering. You could do some small lots if you mixed it up with some really big lots. The council came back and provided direction in the interim regulations that their intent was that that density be dispersed throughout the development so that you have larger lots averaging no less than 18,000 square foot lot size. So that's where we wanted to bring it back to the Planning Commission and take it through the public process as well to get your recommendation as to if you concur or if you have different recommendations.
Okay.
So that goes along with edits throughout a number of different sections in the municipal code where we had to change bulk and dimensional standards, had to change performance standards, et cetera, to reflect the different lot size in the CLDRM.
So I'll open up to the Planning Commission. I don't necessarily want to go page by page again, but if we need to, we can. I don't have any edits up until I think bulk and dimensional standards. So if there's anybody else that has any comments or questions or changes to be made before then, you want to go first, please let me know.
If I remember correctly, the reason the clustering conversation came up was related to topography and or flood wave or flood zone circumstances where if a larger lot would allow for dwelling units or two dwelling units or whatever that scenario was, that we were giving some flexibility to the landowner to say, well, you know, you could only get one there if there's only one technical building site.
Right.
But we're going to allow two to four. I remember when all this conversation happened.
Yeah, the idea is clustering to accommodate the
to use
the different contexts of critical areas and flood rights, etc.
Which was from an owner's perspective, the best use of the land. He's allowed to cluster in a particular knoll, if you will. That's far better than that knoll's only going to work for one, even though otherwise you'd have two or four. Is that tracking right?
Yeah, that was from the original Planning Commission recommendation.
I always love it when we send stuff up to council and they send it back with a change, like we didn't think about it the first time.
Part of it was that the council then amended the CLDR zone to include some additional areas outside of the floodplain, and I think that's where the concern that they had was we could just wind up with a tight cluster that looks just like a low-density residential zone and preserves the rest of the site in a very low-density state. And they didn't feel that that was the look and feel that they were looking for with the constrained low-density residential zone.
So as as it's written now, it's not clustering that's allowed. It's just two.
Yes.
And it's up to that
would be the
to
amendment.
Figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Besides the two, is there any notation made on the deed that there won't be any infilling will be allowed at some future point?
Not unless the zoning were to change.
We see it all the time, where 20 years from now, that's, we're all going to forget about what we zoned it the way it was. We're going to put more houses in that space. We need more houses. But
we have to amend
the reason why we made it low density is because of the nature of the site. So unless the site changes in some way that permits additional houses, I just want to make sure that at some point down the road or made the decision because of environmental reasons that's overlooked for expediency for getting more density. How do we do that?
That's a whole can of worms.
Yeah. Zoning can change depending on the interests of the citizens that are elected at the time. There's going to be obviously environmental constraints within the floodplain and floodway, and some of that is naturally going to limit your density. There's state laws that address a lot of those things. Outside of critical areas, should the city at some point in the future wish to upzone, they could do that. And the development patterns, though, are largely what are going to establish what the build-out scenario is. Like, you could rezone Wood River, for example, to 4 units per acre, but you're not likely to have a bunch of houses that suddenly fill in between the other ones.
You're talking about a deed restriction. Somebody goes on title of the property.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about. I'm trying to look at it. I feel like that's kind of unprecedented. Is there something you're thinking about?
I'm in a precedent-making mood right now.
I knew that was going on.
No, I mean, we know these larger areas out there by the highway are, they got shallow water table. You're talking about a lot of this, but and even think about putting any house out there at all, it's a concession to private ownership. You don't want to make the properties unusable, but probably a lot of that we're thinking about putting a house or two on probably shouldn't have them anyway. But they have a high enough point. We allow for that. But what bothers me is that 20 years down the road, people sit in this room, probably not this room, but looking at trying to make infill because we're built out, all of a sudden they start saying, well, forget about the zoning back then. We need space. So they start compromising the environment for getting more density. That's all I'm saying.
I guess I'm going to say first that I think when we're planning, we're going 10 to 15 years out. I'd love to sit down with the Planning Commission, who is ever interested, in staff, and we think about what does 20 and 30 and 50 years from now look like for North Bend, and how can we accommodate that. However, I look at those lined areas on the map which indicate the constrained residential zone, and they're at the edges of the city, or they're around the floodplain or floodway. I don't think flood insurance would be available. I don't think in 10 years that the levee system is fixed. Yeah. So
listen, the people that wrote that RC, that rule about poles, didn't think underground line would be required. There's clearly a law in the books that says above ground poles are preferred, wherever. We're not paying attention to that law. We have another purpose.
Well, it could have been that there were people that things. Were supplying the wood for those poles.
Whatever.
That wrote the law.
Whatever. I'm just saying, poles laws will make a difference when it comes to wanting something. So I'm just saying that if we're serious that that area is constrained because of a wet shallow water tables, that we got to find a way to make sure that's what's going to stay. Now, if you want to go vertical on the two level sites, that's a different story. But But to spread homes out on those areas just because we need infill 20 years from now, that doesn't make a bit of sense.
Well, what you're talking about is the maximum coverage of non-permeable surfaces, and that's in the bulk and dimensional standards. And that gets to the heart of it, right, I think? Isn't that what he's asking about?
It's how much you could cover that. You're talking about stormwater infiltration. Maximum impervious surface for the constrained low-density residential zone is lower based on the overall lot area than it is for the low-density residential zone. That was one of the amendments that was provided in the interim regulations.
Yeah. I wonder if we could even go down that road as far as the deep piece. I don't feel like we could. Our planning, our controls through planning by permits is going to move. It's going to change, like you're pointing out. It may be that 20 years or 50 years from now, infill on these lots is something the city considers.
I think it's also important to recognize that whatever happens 30 years from now is going to happen through the public process.
Right.
So it has to be the citizenry that says, yes, this is a good idea, before it would take place. I guess I would be a little bit reluctant to impose our view of the way things are or should be right now on something long-term into the future with a deed. And an example of that is our CED office has a deed on it that can only be used for municipal government purposes. So
that was
when we build our city hall, we'll have kind of this little miniature white elephant over there.
And here's what we do. We do what we always do. We just simply make a condition of the permit to donate the remaining land to the city. We do a lot of time. If that's how we get open space. You guys got 40 acres, but we only want 10 developed. You can get a permit for 40 homes on that 10 acres, provided he provides the other, a deed to the rest of the property. So on these constrained properties, we make a conditional permit that the property is dedicated to the public.
You're talking about allowing the clustering with the lot size like the LDR zone?
No.
And for the remainder?
I'm just saying if it's one house per 18,000 feet, we're thinking about that the permit will be granted upon the condition of dedicating the property outside the footprint of the home being dedicated to the public.
So Farmer Bob comes in with his 5-acre piece. They happen to have some connection to the river or a wetland or something. And we say to him, all right, pay your submittal fees and sign over a deed to your land of the city for whatever you're not going to use. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'm kind of surprised. Even if it was truly never going to be buildable in anybody's definition, the concept of in order to get a permit from the city to do something, you have to give us the rest. It's always a decision of swapping.
All these pocket parks and these.
That's
all given up by the public use. What are you talking about?
Well, Dick, I think what you're talking about is if you were to take the current CLDR zone provisions, which describe the minimum lot size as the same as the LDR zone, so you do that clustering, you could conceivably cluster all those 2 units per acre into one corner of the property. Then you have a very large lot throughout the rest of the property. Is your idea then that you could turn that large lot into a public dedication? Or you're talking about
it becomes open space, whatever you want to call it, whatever grows there. Mm-hmm. It could be public use, it could be whatever. I'm just saying we do it all the time to protect, to provide open space locally. First Woods has it all over the place. They had all kinds of land dedicated to public use to get the density they got. There's no magic about that. So we have constrained property out here, and it's physically constrained because of water situations. We should recognize that, be willing to take the property off their hands, the unusable property, for some value plus a permit to build on two lots that come out of that. But the rest of it is dedicated open space or there's an easement on it.
So, Mike, the minimum is 2 per acre. Is there a park fee for, I guess, what do you call it, a short plat when they're under 4?
Anything has, okay, there's two components. So there's the park impact fee, which is applied on a per dwelling basis. So no matter how many units you get, whatever number of units you build, it's $4,054 for a single-family home. That's park impact fee. Then there's also the on-site recreation requirements. So that is where if there's over 30 homes in a development, they have to provide a certain, or 5% of the net area of the development for common open space. So mini parks, green belts, etc. If you're under 30, they are required to provide a fee in lieu because it becomes too small of an area to be usable for good park purposes. So then we take the fee in lieu and we collect that, and we use that to buy other more collective open space that works on a broader basis.
And Mike, when you're talking about 30 or more in a development, does it matter the development size of lot?
Well, not the size of the lot. No, it's based on the number of units and the acreage.
Was that created, though, when we had the density of 4?
Yeah, it was.
And so in exchange for that lower density, we were saying to give a park for recreational space because you had smaller backyards. So that's where I'm just at a little bit of an odd of trying to relate this in the same way as a park requirement, that you would give up a portion of your land. If there was a 5% of your net as a park fee or something in a wetland, I still don't know how that's different than just saying, here's the maximum impervious surface, and we're still leaving the rest to nature or to the ability for water to get into the aquifer or to have a place to spread.
So, I guess the...
Go ahead.
Can I cut you off?
No.
A different take on it, and I'm not, like, super familiar with it, but I know in Vermont they have, I want to say, it's like a conservation easement. Right, so you have a large tract of land, and the city doesn't want you to develop it. So you basically sign away your development rights to that land for a huge tax break. You're not taxed as if it's potentially buildable. You're taxed as if it's public land. So with that comes public access to that. And it's not something. The agreement is indefinite. It's not just, you can't then sell the land to a developer. And so it puts it basically in the public trust, but it's not maintained by the city, as I feel like you're suggesting, but it's kind of, it's held by the public.
Yeah, we have the same program in King County.
Okay.
Public benefit rating system. So people can apply to the county, put a piece of their property into a conservation easement. Usually it's because it's wetlands or agricultural land or something. Then that's protected from development in perpetuity, and they get a break in their taxes as a result.
Can you do that in the city? Sorry, can you do that in the city?
Okay.
Can you do that in the city?
People in the city can apply to the county. The city doesn't deal with.
So it's not through the city. It's anybody in King County.
Yeah.
Got it.
But even if they're within the city limits, because they're in King County, they're eligible.
Yeah.
You don't have to.
For example, the subdivision right next to you, the Pulte subdivision.
Yeah.
That property was previously in the public benefit rating system. When they decided to sell for development, they had to pay back all that deferred tax.
Yes.
So they had a big chunk of payment to the county.
Okay.
So then it doesn't protect it forever. It protects it unless somebody's willing to pay that amount.
So then do we modify, to address your concern, Dick, is there a way that we could implement something like that with the safety mechanism to prevent 50 years down the road that being developed?
Well, we can't get involved in taxation as a city.
Okay.
Property tax. In terms of protecting development, if that's something that you wanted to do, it would be through some form of conservation easement. But that, again, I think it's projecting our current views and values way into the future, which is sometimes problematic.
Right. My trouble with, I guess, some of this that we're thinking of the wetlands is today, I don't know what 10 and 20 years from now that's going to look like as a stream. And I'm looking at all the places in California that 3 years ago they had these large reservoirs and now they're bone dry. You know, there's all in Rio and South America, there's the same thing happening around. So is it going to be a wetland 10 years from now? I don't know. And so
in terms of critical areas.
But the council's position is these are boundary areas around our city which should be less dense than the infill. And 10 years from now, as we've built out from the center out of the city, the center should be as dense as possible, and then you get less dense as you move out, as a general thought. I don't know that, other than the max lot coverage, which is in bulk and dimensional, I don't know another way that really stops them, because that would prevent them from doing too many buildings on a lot. It would prevent them from subdividing unless the zoning changed. And if the zoning changed, then there would be a need and a change in the city vision, I guess.
Well, that's the piece that Dick is bringing up, if I'm not misunderstanding you. This is something really wholly different than our documents that people build on. This is talking about a deed restriction on the land, which is perpetuity, and they would in effect allow that to happen. The existing property owner would allow it to happen in order to get something, whatever that means, more density or build it all, whatever. And I'm on one level, that's kind of a cool idea. I like to trade and swap and bargain, and okay, that gives the landowners some control of what they're trying to do. But I also think it's only been less than a year since we've told these poor landowners that they don't have what they thought they had, that some of them probably hadn't figured it out yet. So I'm pushing back on that idea to say, why in the heck would we tell them, first of all, we're going to take it away, and then we're going to say, but we'll give it back to you if we can take more away. That's the concept I'm interpreting as if I were the owner of the property that's impacted by this.
And I don't think the city wants to get involved in deed restrictions for things that are outside of critical areas.
Yeah.
That's just a lot of additional process. And
but I can't help but hear in my ears Councilwoman Patterson saying that this is what rural's all about, these large lots.
And that's what the council has recommended that we're taking back to the process.
And that's what we're doing. But you're saying come five councils out, there'll be a different attitude because they realize that they're losing that. They know they have no longer, they have no more buildable space than they need. They have demand, so they're going to start looking for ways to build on vacant land. And so all the good reasoning for not impacting the sense of lands goes away.
I disagree.
They start misinterpreting rules of the state because they want to do something different.
Well, we're always going to be bound to the rules of the state.
But what I'm saying is, we're seeing what happened right here in this document with regards to underground power.
I disagree with your sentiment that these are the first lands we look at redeveloping. I think, in first and foremost, we're looking at the North Bend downtown area, and we look at cottage and mixed use, and we look at our 35-foot building height, which is the same for single-family residents as it is for multifamily housing. And we say, how on earth do you do multifamily with such low height? And why not raise that up to 40 or 50? And, you know, think about where that can fit in. Nothing on the north side of North Bend Way, always on the south side, so you protect your views. Not that I've given this a little bit of some thought. So I disagree that CLDR would be the first place in 10 years we're looking for the capacity.
I agree with the
millennial generation.
I'm not trying to say it's be the first. I'm saying it will happen. And if we're serious about protecting the land, the sensitive lands, we've got to put some teeth into when we say we have constrained properties. We need to put force behind that.
If you're talking about constrained properties, we do have a lot of protections in our code right now for constrained properties. So we've got.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about those properties.
Yeah.
Down by the river.
So
we're talking about.
We have streams,
the city.
Stream buffers, wetland buffers, critical aquifer recharge areas. Those all have additional layers of protection, and in the case of those critical area buffers, those are required to be provided into a permanent native growth protection easement or a tract if it's in subdivisions that sets it aside permanently and says you're not going to ever develop this.
I'm going to be alive when this happens. I don't even know why you're going to be alive. But I am trying to suggest, I know people find ways to go around things. Mike, and you do too. And if we want to protect these lands from being impacted more than having that one hole for 18,000 feet, then darn it, we ought to be thinking about how we can create that. Can't just say we've done it and wash our hands of it. It's not done. Temporarily done.
Mike, I know that we've tried to keep our documents clean, and we've tried to minimize the amount of words in them, but in a sentiment like this, would it be permissible to write such a statement that it is the explicit wish of the Planning Commission and City Councils that we preserve our larger lots in our city, which reflect who we are as a rural community, and give the next set of Planning Commissioners that understanding to read in our document? So when you're not here and Jim's not here and I'm not here, none of us are here, they read those words.
So that's in the description of the CLDR zone, and that's something that's been added. That's on page 2 of the ordinance.
I get the furthermore large estate size lots in excess of 18,000, minimum lot size is the intent within the CLDR. Is that?
Yeah.
Can I throw my own knuckle into this? To me, the whole thing, and I'm not going to beat a drum that I was opposed to this zone creation in the first place, but this is another example of kind of how things can go down a certain road. The property owner is not going to build his home where it's going to get washed away. The property owner is not going to put a fuel storage tank under his kitchen and sleep well at night. There's lots of things that we are assuming when we start putting restrictions on the land that the property owner must be a fool. And every time we add more layers of restrictions, that's the message that we're sending, when the reality and the impact to the property owner is we're taking whatever related use of the land away from him. The deed restriction piece, I think it's glorious and the right example, but to apply it to this area that we've just newly created as a further dart in the map to say we're going to further restrict your land if you want to do anything with it, it's offensive to me. It's got to be, if the individual owners were really paying attention to it, they'd have to be coming here tonight going, are you out of your minds? It's easy for us to go and put more and more restrictions on land because we feel like that's the job we're doing. But I think it's a harm to at least the property owner, if not to the future development of the city, when we go from this rural, cool place to a place that nobody can do anything in because we decided to protect it all. Pardon me for going off on a tangent. Right.
So now I've got a piece of land out there that has 18,000 square feet. My neighbor has 18,000 square feet. We live on this beautiful rural half-acre lot. Feeling pretty good about this. Also, my neighbor dies, and his family comes in and wants to subdivide that property. And you got 20 homes next to your beautiful country estate.
You just became a multimillionaire.
How's that done you any favors?
If that happened, I just answered the question, I think. As my neighbor gets older, I know the specifics are hard, details to get that way, but that is the evolution. If growth comes and my neighbor's land is worth so much that somebody's going to come do that on it, I'm probably doing okay, too.
But this is land you said is constrained. This is land that says...
In order for that to happen, the subdivide, correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, you have to change the zone.
you would have to change the zone, and that has to go through the public process.
And he would petition the city, go through the docketing process, and we would look at why in the CLDR area would we want to have one area of low density and everything else constrained. And, you know, if it's on a corner, maybe there's a chance. But in the middle of it, it's going to be up to that commission at that time.
I think one other thing to think about with deed restrictions is with the deed restriction, you're providing a artificial clamp, for no better word, on a property that doesn't then get to change with market factors. So you could wind up pricing yourself off your land over time. If you have an 18,000 square foot lot and the price of land keeps going up and up and up and you can't do anything to subdivide it to offset your costs, it could become too expensive for you to live on.
Or not. Because you're a little square, all of a sudden, with taxes, which we all are going to continue to grow, that whole point. I mean, I like this conversation because I know lots of people are having it maybe without articulating it. But another example that I think fits in what you just said is the Prop 13 in California, and it's true in different states where they've said, hey, you know, you can homestead your property if you've reached a certain age or whatever, and we're not going to raise your taxes, whatever the calculation is. Well, that puts the 80, 90-year-old grandparent in a home, and they can't afford to sell it or move because if they move their taxes, they can't afford to pay the taxes where they might go to get something similar. There's dynamics, and you start tying a property. When the government thinks it's doing a good job by restricting property, there's the backside is usually individuals.
We're even kidding ourselves. We're saying these properties are constrained. So we're going to allow one residence on 80,000 square feet. Okay. Now, we're saying it's constrained. Well, we're not going to do anything about it other than put a zone on it and then let the devil take the hindmost. You know, we're just going to let it go.
But we've done a lot already.
But it makes certain council members feel good about what they're doing, but it's not doing anything long term to actually protect the property. And as planners, to quote a phrase of my favorite forest instructor, he says, you speak for the trees, we speak for the land in this room. We don't speak for the owners, we speak for the land. And if the land can't carry full-out development because it's impacted by natural conditions, we have to recognize that and protect it.
So you're talking about the environmentally constrained properties, which was, I think, the original intent of the CLDR zone from the Planning Commission.
That's what the council, the constrained low density.
Yeah, so when the council took it up, the comp plan amendments, they expanded the zone to a number of additional areas that are not necessarily constrained by floodplains or other critical areas. So adjacent to Wood River, along Maloney Grove and 436, there's a lot of areas outside the floodplain there that are just developable land.
Yeah.
So I think if your concern is about protecting truly environmentally constrained areas, we could look at other tools to get there through other limitations on impervious surface, for example, on floodplain regulations, other things that would get more specific to those environmental constraints.
Because we do have a whole flood plan, you know, comprehensive plan that talks about lot development and heights and level above flood level that you have to build.
And Dick, I'll add this to our conversation at least and say, I for one believe, sure, there's a factor taking care of the land, but I think we're here first for the people. Those people own the land, and to the greatest degree, we should allow them to do whatever they want to do with their land. And I also think that the people that own the land are probably far better stewards of it than we're ever going to overlay a district on. So,
Yeah. You're talking about individuals and residential versus business stewardship. Because I will disagree with you on business stewardship.
It does. Well, then we probably should never have expanded I-10, right? Leave it as a single track road. Leave the railroads or whatever.
I've gone way down this road, probably with some misinformation. I thought that the city council was looking at allowing development on property that's constrained, but they might have an LDR zone on it, 4 homes an acre, but you're never going to get 4 homes on that acre. But instead of putting 4 cluster homes, put 1 home on it, and just call it good. And that will help us develop or reestablish this rural feeling of large lot in the rural area. I thought that was where they were going with this. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden, it's not where they're going with it in terms of what you're saying, Mike, that there'll come a time where they'll be allowed to put a third and fourth home on that 18.
Well, that's not any intent through this council. I'm just saying at some point in the future that may happen.
I hope you long live past the frustration, Nick.
I'm going to live past my last borrow time. No, you guys, I wasted my time here, I think, because I thought we were talking about physically constrained property. We were talking about doing something to protect sensitive lands, allowing that developer to get that one house at least so they can make something out of it instead of do nothing with it.
You used to have 4, now we can only have 1. Yeah. That's what's happened.
Elizabeth?
I don't think that you're completely. Our original conversations about constrained low density residential were focused on areas that were primarily floodway. Yeah. So, in that, you were remembering absolutely correctly that our original intent was more to define what they can actually do. Because when you look at those properties, anyone who's been out to Twin Falls sees what can happen, where you end up with, yes, they're really big lots, but most of them drop off a cliff to the water below, and they're right on top of each other. So it's been expanded in a way that I think creates a little bit of confusion for those of us who were here for the original conversation, because it was very much focused on essentially reflecting a condition that existed, which was that they were already greatly limited in what they could build in those areas because of floodway requirements. They are the state saying the city cannot issue a permit to construct in the floodway.
Hey, Mike, how come CLDR wasn't put over Wood River, for instance, so that has large
confusion.
Sorry, I thought you were done, Elizabeth.
I don't know. I think just that it's an existing built-out condition. It probably wasn't much thought of.
And like La Forest that has big lots.
Yeah.
I have an answer. We created a tool. City Council said, oh, interesting. Where else can we apply this tool? And it didn't make any sense to even talk about it with an existing neighborhood. They use it to restrict land and growth. At the same time, they were having conversations about wider streets, narrower streets, and didn't like what was going on. So politically, they sat in a room and said, let's use this paintbrush. That's what happened.
All right, so let's move on. That was a interesting and well discussed.
Did we accomplish anything?
We did, in the fact that when we get to talking about floodplain and wetlands and sensitive areas, that Dick will have a key role.
He always has a key role to play.
You're right. Moving on into our LDR and constrained low-density residential sections. Any other thoughts or changes as you look through there?
The piece that comes to me often is we just look into the other graphics that have been created.
Where are you going?
I'm just generally stating anything which compare one zone to another.
Uh-huh.
The low-density zone that we already had,
you're
or
on
we
page.
Still have, well, any of them, or the chart, any of the graph charts. LDR versus CLDR, I struggle with why there should ever be a difference in how we have this graphic set up.
Why we should treat the CLDR zone different than the LDR?
Yes.
that just comes back to, I think, the direction the council wanted to see a constrained low-density residential feeling more rural, and therefore not allowing certain things that are allowed in the LDR zone, like the mix of cottages up to 15% or mixed housing types. A few other things in there, like adult family homes, homes for the elderly and related, that they didn't want to see in the constrained low-density residential.
So one, this might be an oversight, but I'm under 4.0 public and quasi-public.
Uh-huh, page 16.
Yeah, page 16. So it doesn't appear, even though we just had a conversation about putting property in public use for perpetuity, we can't put a park, an open space trail for recreation.
Yes.
That's an interesting one there. I'll have to...
Yeah.
I'm thinking it's an oversight somewhere.
Probably an oversight.
I would like a P there. What about golf courses or athletic or sports fields?
Those have considerably higher potential impacts. Sports fields in particular, you're getting a lot of noise, a lot of traffic.
But I don't know. I mean, if I look at that one big swath outside city limits that's in King County right now, and I was a developer thinking of a golf course, and I could build my big homes all around it and put a golf course in the center.
Doesn't commercial use change things?
Well, it'd be golf private, owned by the homeowners.
There's a lot of fertilizers and stuff that golf courses use. Mm-hmm. It's a low water table.
Not that area. Thinking. Well, I don't know.
I mean, you're thinking along the South Fork anywhere.
Yeah, I guess there were some of those.
You'd have a heck of an argument. selling the infrastructure related to a golf course. Well, you told the original property owner you could only have one house on the same land.
I'm thinking he buys up all those lots.
Okay.
I actually not thought about this, but it's an unpopular comment I'm about to make, but having athletic fields would be chemicals that frequently are used and maintaining them to the proper standards. The traffic, I don't know that the 14.13 is appropriate for considering buildings in business. And right now there's a P there. That's permitted. I mean, just imagine the we're in an area already, you know, so you're going to go in there and spray fertilizer to keep the baseball field looking good or the soccer field looking good in an area where it's going to wash right into the river.
How do you feel about schools?
You know, they kind of have the same problems.
Because they're permitted too.
So I don't disagree. I kind of hear what you're saying. If we're trying to promote a rural feel, although a baseball field would be rural.
Lights, so that it can be used later at night. Traffic.
I actually think that ball fields really do belong more in the urban area. You have more services. All those kids get out of games and want to have hamburgers and have stuff. They want whatever they want. There should be more developed area.
And I realize that we don't have a lot of spaces to put more, and there is incredible demand in our area, not always from people in our area for them, but...
Are you talking about schools? Or?
I was talking on the sport.
4.13.
Schools are a different deal. I think sometimes we're kind of stuck with that. It's where they own land and can build. And it's where the land is affordable enough to put it.
What if the schools and sports facility kind of related items were actually conditional use permit?
We have tried to avoid conditional use permits throughout our table of uses in that they add a lot of process and a lot of politics, but don't necessarily address the true mitigation issues that the CUP is intended to do.
Okay.
So from staff perspective, it's much simpler to say it's allowed or it's not allowed.
Yeah, let's not debate.
Yeah.
Every applicant gets a whole debate process.
Yeah.
I see your point.
So on 4.13, just, I don't know if we're all clear, remove the P. I agree with Elizabeth based on traffic. And what you're trying to promote as a rural zone, they don't fit.
Yeah. And I think that we'd have the same issue with where they want to place these structures.
And it, in exchange, allow a park which can promote some activity or some frisbee throwing, yoga, whatever.
That's it. Frisbee throwing yoga. That's
well, there you go.
Sort of fits in there.
Launch the North Bend.
Is there a consensus on that?
Yeah. So I'm sorry, I didn't hear the number. Was it four, open space 4.1?
4.13.
Okay.
We're removing
adding a P at 4.1.
Okay. Yep. Removing the P. Got it. And then that same logic, if I may suggest, follows everything under heading 4.30. Schools, churches, mass transit, temporary public plaza buildings, that sort of thing.
Now, some of those we allow in every zone, so it might be a little bit of a different context to disallow them in the CLDR.
So a high school could go into this zone?
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, and that is obviously a larger impact type of use.
Let's not have a second high school in the floodway.
We already have one.
We do.
That's also one with churches, too. But I see what you're saying.
Mass transit facility?
It's just consistency.
Yeah, it's consistent.
Why not the interpretive?
What exactly, or maybe just generally, what's a temporary public or quasi-public building or uses? What is that?
That's a good way.
Almost tense. It's kind of like if it kind of sort of might be. That's really weird language.
Well,
that could be like.
I don't know what that is.
Let's say that we had a significant earthquake in City Hall and other facilities became unusable and we wanted to put up some metal.
Well, that'd be an emergency.
Whatever.
Override.
But it would be a temporary or quasi-public. Well, you're sure that's true. There's probably something.
What about the Warrior Dash that erected up some temporary stuff?
I don't know.
Well, but it says public or quasi-public buildings, so.
That was for the public.
Could I go so far as to make a formal request of staff that they research that language and see if it applies anywhere? For real?
What would it be?
Is there such thing as
it's either a carte blanche to do whatever we want, or it shouldn't be there.
So you're looking for examples on 4.70?
How
would that be used, or when would it be used?
I'm not sure what quasi-public really is concerning city.
Quasi-public typically refers to things that are in the general public interest but aren't specifically public. Youth organizations, Cub Scouts, those types of things.
Red Cross?
Yeah.
Okay.
But then those things would be allowed or not specifically already.
Yeah.
Well, they might set
up some research and find out.
If this doesn't fit, let's try it in there.
If we didn't have churches or schools nearby, they might set it up in a
location. Well, the structures are damaged, they have temporary structures that you can put up.
But like Jim said, if there's an earthquake, we're not going to be looking to the zoning table.
No, it's going to be like put it where you've got a clear field.
Yeah.
But I would also argue that if we had a catastrophe, that the constrained low density residential area, for the most part, is not where you want to put them.
And the other, if you caught this just below that, 4.75, in case 4.70 wasn't confusing enough.
No, that's where we have a section of the code that describes what you do for unlisted uses. So
just go black box.
process of determining what is it most similar to, and if you need an administrative interpretation, you take that through the council. And
gotcha. What are the asterisks?
That refers to a specific performance standard for that use. So the performance standards are additional qualifications or conditions that apply. So as an example, private public utilities, there's probably standards about screening for infrastructure and substations and things like that. Those specific conditions and requirements are in section 18.10.050.
Okay. Because the 4.5 had an asterisk, not that maybe it was an ink splash, but.
Yeah, that's.
And there's notes at the end of each table that define some of the notes or footnotes or the asterisks, the ones and twos. So on page 19, I think that's at the end of the table you were looking at, Dick. Thank you. That under the prohibited uses is slaughterhouses. Appreciate that, having just watched a Vice episode.
Now there is a 2.19 which allows for mini golf courses.
Awesome.
As opposed to full golf courses.
Where are you again?
Never mind, I'm just being silly.
I don't remember seeing. Okay, Mike, I have a question for you on page 22. This is not related to constrained low-density residential. Under commercial districts, upper floor dwelling units, I, has 1,000 square feet. Is that the minimum amount for that floor, for that dwelling unit? Is 1,000 square feet?
Yeah, that's right. Minimum of 1,000 square feet per dwelling unit in that zone.
Okay. Is there a way that we can say that these are minimums, or?
It says that they're minimum lot size on page 21. That's the heading there.
Yeah, but these aren't lots, as they're dwelling units, and that's why I'm asking.
It says it in the notes in the heading there, upper floor dwelling units, parentheses, in mixed-use buildings, lot area per dwelling unit.
Got it. Okay.
Just didn't catch it in the when we ran it through the copy machine. It's in the electronic version.
Okay. That's supposed to be an 8.
Yeah.
So Mike, I was just going to ask, with the setbacks, either front, side, or rear setbacks, when we have something that's in the floodway, can you and the planning department make exceptions to those based on certain property constraints?
Well, we don't allow any new residential or commercial uses in the floodway, or buildings in the floodway. So are you talking about floodplain broadly?
I guess so.
Floodway is moving water.
Yes.
So in the floodplain, a lot of the areas of the floodplain are within shoreline jurisdiction. And our shoreline regulations do prescribe larger lot bulk and dimensional standards.
So if there was a wetland on the property that was cutting across the front of it that goes back to that river, can they set it back and encroach on the back 25? Where it's safe?
Yeah, that we have what's called a reasonable use exception process. And it's for addressing circumstances like that.
That's all I was asking. A reasonable?
There's a couple different processes. There's a variance process and a reasonable use exception process and an administrative adjustments to bulk and dimensional standards process. So each of those addresses circumstances where putting it in the square box is not going to fit.
Got it. That makes sense. You had something, Mr. Lucky?
Nope, I'm passing on my topic.
Okay.
And I found another one.
Mr. McCartney?
I did find another one.
Okay.
So, the daycare conversation, daycare center.
What page are you on?
Sorry, page 3. It's 1.3 section. We've added a missive for that, I'm assuming, just to be logical. Mm-hmm. But isn't that typically a business? Mm-hmm. I mean, these people are not dropping off this
child family. Daycare center, yes. Family daycare provider, that's where you have just a parent that's got 4 or 5 kids in the home as well. But I think a child daycare center is more of the business.
So, under the heading, this is actually constraining and lower land use, how do we allow a, quote, business to operate there?
That's policy call.
That's my question.
Yeah.
I guess my only thought of that is I think of Montessori schools, which have some pre-care and after-care, and it's not technically school. That would be child care facility at that point. So if we're going to allow a Montessori school, wouldn't we want to allow their before and after-care under that heading of child care? That's the only use.
And that goes back to the we can do a high school here, so why can't we do a daycare center?
Well, I think it comes down to definitions and what they're actually, are we talking about, I can't remember the name of it, the Goddard School style child care center, like they just had it open in Snoqualmie, or are we talking about the definition of when a home daycare becomes a child care center? And for the state, that's the number of children that are in the space. It may still be occurring in someone's residence,
right. But
I think it's when you get over 6, and it's between the 7 and 12 mark that you're still allowed to have in a residential structure. It is then considered a child daycare center by virtue of the number, not a difference in the building that's being used.
So why wouldn't we then offer adult family home in that location?
There's a point.
It's kind of like the pendulum. We can dance it all or mm-hmm. stop here and there.
It's a very good point. I have a lot of years you deal with adult family homes. Most all the governments and residential communities are simply set up in a home that is, you know, 4 bedrooms, mm-hmm. 3 baths, you know, a large home. But you wouldn't know it if you didn't know it. That there's an adult family home there. I think this should be totally permitted in single family dwelling units. I mean, just call it.
So I'm struggling with the conflict here. A couple of them that I've seen. One of them is we've gone the evolution, if you follow some logic, is saying, okay, low density residential is this group of restrictions. We have a new zone that we're tweaking called constrained low density residential, and we're layering what that means. And right now, there's several items, particularly this 1.3 heading of land uses, that says these are fairly, most people would consider them a business. Mm-hmm. And then as we keep going, what I've just started, okay, so let's say we do the child care thing, that seems reasonable. And let's say the adult family home, that seems reasonable. And you keep going down this chart here, and you see, well, how about a secure community transition facility? If you let one in, how can you stop the train?
And that's one of the very rare circumstances where you only allow it through a conditional use permit, because it isn't much.
That's actually what I was going to bring up.
So if we went to an extreme, maybe we only allowed single-family dwellings in the constrained district cutting out. That would be one way to cut it off instead of just saying, oh, well, I can justify this. Are you okay with that? That's where Jim's going with it.
Well, and my real lean is to say, again, back to the vision of the person who's signing up or owns land under this definition, they're not expecting their next-door neighbor to be X. Because it doesn't make any sense. It's not why they're living there. It's not why they bought land or have land and kept it in that area. To me, it's a conflict. It's a double conflict when if you're making an argument that low-density residential is less restrictive than constrained.
But as a property owner in there, and I'm your neighbor, and I want to sell, you're taking away the boxes that I could sell it for.
And you've asked to put in a car dealership, and I'm saying no to that, too.
That is totally different.
There's a limitation, right? Yeah, we go back and forth.
Encompass is in EP1 right now, are they not?
No, Encompass is over in the, it's called the urban separator overlay district.
So it's not EP1?
No. Let me throw in another question, because this could come up. Let's say that this is a well-established zone now. 5 years, 10 years, everybody's familiar and has seen some new construction and they kind of get a feel for what it's like. And one of the owners comes to the city and says, you know, it doesn't allow it here, but I'd like to do this. What's the process that right now, if they did it, what would they need to go through to actually change
something? So the planning commission receives dockets every year.
Yep.
You guys would see that request and you'd say, is this a good idea? Do we want to take it up? You take it up, then it goes through the public process. We hold a hearing on it. Staff makes some recommendation, prepares a staff report. You guys would then consider it based on the public comment you received, move it up to council. Here's the Planning Commission's recommendation on this issue. Council then debates it, has additional opportunity for comment, and then they take action.
So if I generalize, if we don't put the P in the box tonight, in the next few years, and someone wants to do something like one of these things described, mm-hmm. they might be able to get the permission to do so, yeah. And process might take a year.
Yeah.
Or they might not.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited about the idea that they have an opportunity to still do it, but I'm not excited about putting it in and having it be there for free, so to speak. Mm-hmm. If we're going to create this constrained area, a business operating, that doesn't make sense.
So you're suggesting that the child care center should have the P struck?
Correct. Family daycare provider and the child daycare center.
So family daycare provider, again, is a much smaller scale. So that would be saying you as a parent cannot watch somebody else's kids for money in your home.
You don't mean to say that to you, Jim.
Well, I guess I struggle with the language of that and how that would actually work. I mean, we've all driven through neighborhoods, you know, where the kids are playing out in the yard and the next door neighbors will tell you, oh yeah, it's 7:22 because they're all getting dropped off right now. That's a business to the immediate neighbors. That's an activity that there's noise, there's activity, there's cars coming and going. So to the immediate neighbors, it's a business. Now, I'm not saying that'd be a great neighbor to have if I had kids, trust me, that had that age, but I'm... impact to the neighbors, it's a business.
Yeah, do
at
we,
least
do
twice
we allow,
a day.
Do we allow in this code something like seamstress work? Can you do?
You can have home occupations throughout the city.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's limitations on what you can do for a home occupation. Yeah. Generally, it's things that are low impact, don't bother the neighbors.
Just trying to
things.
Get the term business. Meaning a lot of different things, not just child daycare. You'd expect child daycare in a family community. You would.
So is the length? Is the
you're
language,
talking about noise and traffic?
I'm talking about a dozen kids. That'd be different. Now, that's not what this is.
And so is the language about this? Is the language behind 1.32A? Is that language? How does that define? Is it number of children?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we've got specific definitions for both of those, and I believe they are consistent with state definitions.
Mm-hmm. Is it something like five children or something?
It's usually going to be a maximum of six, depending on the age.
Where would a guard
room come from? They're only allowed to have four, unless they have someone else working with them.
So those would probably be more under schools,
under schools.
As a category.
Okay.
Depends on the age of the kids. For state law.
Unless the underline comes from the daycare.
That's just where it's being, in red line format, it's being added.
Oh, okay.
I just have a question on how the zoning works, like the Cascade Church or something on 436. Is that, so that's zone LDR?
That one's in the cottage residential zone.
Before the fact.
Or after the fact, churches are allowed in that zone.
But that wasn't originally a cottage when that was built.
And that was built in under King County regulations before it was annexed.
So that would be grandfathered in.
Grandfathered in, but even if it were to be built today, it could be built. It's a permitted use in the cottage residential zone.
So let's see. So how do you, how does the dwelling units work? Because no one's dwelling in the church.
It just doesn't apply. As a school, anywhere that school would be allowed, which is throughout the city.
Or they can get on the docket and go to where they want.
So if you look on page 17 under 4.30 school, you can see all the P's in the zones. That's the easiest way to do that. Same thing, your question about churches and religious institutions, there's P's in most. Why not an interchange mixed use?
I don't know.
Because isn't there the church for the truckers in the exit 34?
May just be a prior error.
Does that help?
Yeah, I can't imagine how you would just allow high schools in any zone in the city.
Does that fall under one of those things where we basically can't stop them? Because it's a public...
I don't think so. It's not a free speech protection type of thing.
Well, I was just talking about public facilities.
Yeah.
Issues in terms of public facilities. If there's some state law that basically means we can't...
I'm not aware of it.
I can't think of it in a town our size any heavier use other than industrial that the high school would.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Even a hotel wouldn't be as impactful as a high school.
Mm-mm.
And the band plays on.
Just being Snoqualmie behind the outside.
It looks like we're just trying to duck any controversy by just saying, okay, well, anything go anywhere.
That's not going to duck controversy.
It's being open to opportunities.
Is that pretty consistent among all jurisdictions?
So when I was in Snoqualmie, I think it was the same way.
Yeah.
It seems like it tells the community that the Planning Commission can't make any decisions. They're just let everything go everywhere. That's not planning.
Well, there's certainly a lot of limitations for other uses. It's just recognizing the public nature of that type of use. I think for your purposes tonight, you're making a recommendation on the CLDR zone. So if you want to say high schools are not appropriate in the CLDR zone, you could do that. But I don't think we should start going beyond that into other zones and changing.
But you know I wanted to.
Yeah.
I have a whole host of edits for you, Mike. How can we go about making changes to the other zones, I guess? Welcome dimensional standards. Is that something I can request to be put on a calendar?
On the calendar.
Or do you want to do it in this? Or do you want to do it in this item now?
I think it would be wise just to keep the focus on the CLDRs here just to be able to move that process ahead and not get bogged down. And if you make changes to something that's not in the, that was not previously noticed, we have to re-notice it, and it could get us kind of spiraling.
We all have to spiral, don't we? Round and round and round.
Well, then I will just say that on page 31, under the triplex, fourplex, and multifamily structures, I struggle with the HDR height being the same as the North Bend and downtown commercial or IMU being less. So,
clarify again, where are you at?
Page 31. Mm-hmm. It's the building height. Point F.
Okay.
So it should be 45?
I don't know. I think we ought to discuss that at some point. That a multifamily structure might be different, and whether it has to go in an overlay area or we have to condition it, you know, so you protect views and you dictate where you can do those allowable heights. I just think we should have that discussion at some point.
So you're not just talking CLDR?
Correct. I am going out of scope, but I'm just wanting to take the temperature. Let's see.
I'm just noticing something myself. I was paying attention to a specific zone. I'm kind of questioning actually the lower height that's listed under commercial districts for properties that are in the special flood hazard area. That by virtue of the fact they're in a special flood hazard area, have to be elevated. Yet, we have a lower height.
I agree with you on that.
It's
a little backwards.
Or is that measured from their base floor to the top?
See, and that's what I would
and
be wondering.
And because they're elevated, it's a consistent.
It's not. It's based on ground elevation.
Yeah,
so
that's
it's
an
backwards.
Inconsistency, particularly when the, and another, the trend has been to increase how high you're elevating. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's not been adopted to 3 feet.
2 feet.
Okay, so there's you're still at 2. Snoqualmie and King County are 3 feet. So when we're talking about those sorts of elevation differences, actually look, there's an inconsistency there, and I can't believe I didn't notice until.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. Mm-hmm. So what we can do is flag those issues for coming back to at some point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, page 33. Here's where we get into the maximum building cover, percent of lot area or project depending on the zone. Right? I think that's where I'm at. No, maximum impervious surface coverage, percent of lot area or project. And so we have... our cottage residential is at 55%, and our LDR is at 65%.
Our CLDR is at 55%. Is that what you meant?
Did I say that wrong? I'm sorry. Yeah, I meant.
We just tried to be special here. Why did somebody change that?
Why is it lower for the CLDR?
65% across the board, mm-hmm. except for CLDR.
That was recognizing that you've got a lot more lot area to work with. And so trying to keep that lot area from being paved over by an enormous house and barn and whatnot. I think the idea was to recognize the larger lot size.
So in the real world, builder wants to go in, homeowner, soon to be homeowner, wants to build a nice house, whatever, call it a 5,000-foot two-story, 10,000-square-foot house. Big roof. He's got a reasonably long driveway. Can he meet or exceed this with a water retention vault? Or does this just...
That doesn't address water retention. infiltration. This is purely about impervious surfaces.
Okay, without regard to that, okay.
Mm-hmm. And just so you know, under your example, all that would be permitted within 55% because you're actually looking at 9,900 square foot of coverage. And my question is to the Planning Commission, is that too much? I don't know.
Is 55% too much?
Yes. And I'm thinking if these are supposed to be rural, you know, then the lot size should reflect rural. And sometimes that means smaller homes on bigger lots. And because you're stewards of the land.
And what are our lot sizes here?
18,000 minimum. Minimum. Mm-hmm.
I think we run into just the very real fact that lots of that size in this area are going to be estate homes.
They are going to be.
They're going to be larger homes.
Sure. And you could have a 9,900 square foot Rambler.
Arched stucco homes. Mediterranean style. Mm.
They're pink, right?
Yeah. Or Spanish. Yeah. Nice French tutor. So, you know, I'm thinking, what's wrong with 45%? I can still build a huge mansion. Or I could build a
You can't have a long driveway to get to the front door.
That is a good point. If you're putting a driveway to serve larger homes, that's going to eat up a lot of impervious surface. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Your setback is 30 feet minimum, right? 10 foot wide, 300 square feet minimum, plus in front of the garage, 100 foot wide for 30 feet, another 300 square feet, so that's 600 square feet of a paved roadway. Yeah. Maybe you have another paved around for your RV, so add in, call it 1,000 square foot good. Subtract that out, you can still build your 5,000, 6,000 square foot.
So, I think this is another real-world comment. It does come back to the driveway. I mean, the roof is already a piece of the impervious. The driveway is another level, and so would be any kind of even gardening, I guess, if you didn't have the right kind of soil or use concrete areas to get there and pathways. The 5% variable here between every other zone or every other use, 65 to 55, that just means the owner is going to say to himself, you know, maybe I'll pave 2 inches narrower on each side of my driveway to get to this number. I don't know that it actually accomplishes anything.
You're thinking too small. These guys are also going to have a tennis court and a pool. Mm-hmm.
Well, then that's what I'm saying. It's not going to, the 10% variation is not going to change anything. So it's just a frustration.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I appreciate the discussion.
Is this only on new development that the?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So if they put in a tennis court later, there wouldn't be a reassessment on the impervious.
Well,
coverage.
Sorry, misunderstood your question. That would be.
If it triggers a permit, then we would review it. Okay. The tennis court probably wouldn't trigger a permit.
But if you were an existing person that already had the tennis court in the building and it was over 55%, you would be fine because you're an existing structure.
So it wouldn't, I mean, what you're proposing wouldn't limit future services. It would just be they could expand their driveway later on.
What we're proposing would limit future. But if somebody already had their home established and they already had their driveway and their tennis court and swimming pool and they were above the 55%, this doesn't apply to them. It only applies if they were permitting to go up and they would reach the 55 or go above it, then they would be not.
They could be close to that threshold and want to put a barn in the backyard and they couldn't put in the barn because they'd be up against the threshold.
I don't think I've quite hit the 55%. I'm close, but maybe I'm over. I'm not sure. I'm thinking about it. Like, I've got shy acre, but I've got an outbuilding, a shop and a loft above it.
Another consideration, I think, with this is with the larger lots, you're more likely to have ramblers, which eat up a lot of surface area.
Yeah.
So.
But I've also got a huge rock wall in my place that takes up square feet. And I probably be worth 55%, and yet it doesn't feel like it.
So that's 23,000 square feet of 23,000 square feet of coverage. That is what you're saying you have.
It doesn't feel like it.
You have an acre, that's 43,000.
It's a shy acre. It's 0.9.
What if I want to have a circular driveway instead of one that just straight ends in my garage? And what if I'm actually having to choose between a two-story, which my neighbors can see, and a Rambler based on this equation?
You can have a Rambler currently, which is 9,900.
It would be cheaper for me to build a 5,000 square foot two-story and have less impervious surface. And now my neighbors are looking at my roof instead of not seeing me at all.
They won't see through the trees.
This feels, the restriction feels like it. I'm not sure where the number came from. Was there some logic that somebody said, let's put this 55? And
I don't know how that was developed. But.
I think it was constrained land. Thinking about that, just that name suggested smaller.
I think probably the principal consideration is that we're going from 4 units per acre to 2 units per acre, and from 8,000 square feet to 18,000 square feet. You've got a lot more land to deal with, so didn't want to fill up all that land with impervious surface.
The other thing that's consistent, to your point, in most other places that we apparently allow 75% coverage area if it's a triplex, a fourplex, or other multifamily structure. So the iteration from 4 units to 2 and now say 55%, I mean, I guess it's another poke in the right direction to restrict the land use, but I don't see the value in it. It creates a problem for again, sorry to keep harping my drum.
I'm hearing you saying, I think, Mike, maybe we are overthinking this, because these large homes are likely, if they're being a rural lifestyle, that they are going to have a horse or two. Yeah. They are going to have a barn. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be essential to that kind of lifestyle. So maybe 55% is a little high or low. I don't know.
Yeah. I personally concur with that. I think keeping it at 65%. We've got other limitations with the setbacks and height limit, et cetera.
If I was to ask someone about this, like an expert, which I am not, I don't know if anyone in this room really is on this percentage, but it would be someone in the context of stormwater, some way we'd look at this.
Stormwater still must be addressed, so we're under the King County Surface Water Design Manual. And if you exceed 5,000 square feet of impervious surface, you're into what's called full drainage review. So you're having to provide facilities, stormwater infiltration facilities, to address the stormwater. Yes.
So can I back me up if I'm missing something here? But what that really looks like is you've taken the stormwater and moved it around somewhere on the same piece of property, and you further impacted your impervious surface area, because now you have a vault somewhere on the property that all your gutters run to. Is that
it doesn't have to be a vault. There's tons of different ways to get there. When you exceed 5,000 square feet, you have to address the stormwater.
So I guess what I'm trying to get circle back on is what I've seen happen most is there's a vault, because that's just, okay, here's a dig a hole and we put a concrete vault in there and the water goes there and it takes care of itself. But the people that are actually in the middle of doing it, you go back and forth, because if you've got an impervious surface percentage you're bumping up against, and now in order to treat your stormwater, your choice is shrink your driveway. It's this dance that starts happening, and it all comes back to the impervious surface.
Mm-hmm. It does.
So to circle back to your point, stormwater is separate, but it actually could impact the impervious surface piece of the puzzle too. And it does when you start talking about big houses. I'd love to know where this 55 came from.
Yeah. I'm guessing that Jenna put that together. We can ask her that.
Sounds like a good number.
I guess.
55.
At some point,
I'll just say this because I want this to be on the Planning Commission's mind. Whenever we talk about a commercial area and we talk about a parking lot and it was 12 acres or 20 acres of land and it becomes a paved piece of land and it's over a critical aquifer recharge area, there's something wrong with our policies and we must change those so that doesn't happen anymore. When I think about these lots that are in either sensitive areas or wildlife areas, and that most of our city is the critical aquifer recharge area, I think about how much coverage we should have and how much we how much uncovered or pervious surfaces we need to actually make sure our aquifer is consistently recharged. With the lessening of snowpack, with the lessening and inconsistencies of rainfall, at some point it will be a discussion that some generation of us will have. And I hope we can plan so that it's easier for that next generation to deal with it. That's all I'm going to say.
That's a nice sentiment, but forget about it, because 20 years from now, no one's going to care. They'll be on some other stuff. You just figured that out today, about 2 hours ago.
According to this TED Talk, I think we've landed on Mars in 2027, and we've melted the polar caps to create an atmosphere which raises the temperature, yeah. And we've, you know, colonized it with 2,000 people, so it doesn't matter what happens on Earth.
So
the technology's already
keep
there.
Keep working the DNA and go, we'll all live long enough to do that, right?
Yeah. I have too much time on my hands right now.
I wasn't going to say that, Gary.
All right, so I think I will take away my 45% and be happy with 55%.
Did you were going for 45?
Yes.
Glad I stood my ground on that. So what did we decide to do on this?
We changed some P's.
I have just a comment on that.
Yep.
Page 17 is the one that really, I think, sticks out for me. And it's the, I think it's the LDR and CLDR, and those P's in there are just strange to me. It doesn't seem like a good planning method to just say, well, I mean, I understand if need be, then we'll put a school where you need to put a school, but just down the line, I mean, that's just kind of strange. And then I don't know what the council's intent of CLDR was, but if it was partially to maintain the rural, it's not written that way, actually. So that, I know that was a discussion, but then I went back to what's written. It talks about sensitive environment and sensitive areas, but not to maintain specifically the rural feel and big open lots, as we discussed. But so if that is the case, then as Dick and others were saying, there's a big impact on schools and churches. Whatever the other temporary quasi thing is.
Scott, thank you for your comments. I guess I want to just think about Upstead Elementary. It's Maloney Grove and very rural. Does it fit or not? Sure, it generates traffic, but most times when I drive down that road, I don't see it unless there's two times of the day. So I'm more on the side of keeping it because I've seen where it does work and how it works.
That's not a CLDR zone.
No, that's not. Well, it's
LDR,
but it's not developed as LDR.
Yes.
Right.
And you know what you don't see?
And same thing.
Which I think is very quaint. There's other ways to get to Upstead by walking through some trails they devised on the back end of that. So. See, a lot of kids don't even walk on the streets to get to school. They walk through some woods to get in there, which is really kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. And the school district actually works with the surrounding homeowners for those things, too. So I hear what you're saying. I agree that we should be cautious of high traffic uses. Schools are just kind of that community benefit. They have functions for all the families that live in that
high
area.
Schools are, is it, high schools and middle schools are good. Much.
Well, traffic-wise, it's elementary school because those are the most driven kids. and middle schools and high schools ride bus, or high school bus and drive car.
I didn't. I drove three different times every day for high school.
Yeah, bus or car.
Put the tires up in the parking lot and everything. Okay, fine.
All right, we'll get to talk after. So, any other thoughts on schools in CLDR or LDR?
You're running. Yeah.
No? So, unless you feel strongly otherwise, I'd...
Could you pose your question again, please?
It was his thoughts on schools in CLDR or LDR. And yeah. My thought is that I see how it works, and, you know, as painful as it can be, I think it's limited to two times in a day. And you have to work with the school on lights. That's the only thing.
I would try to put a high school in a residential zone. Try and reserve areas for the schools to negotiate with the city where they put schools, but I think that just to say high school and go any residential areas, that's not planning.
Well, at the same time, you also want to provide schools where residents are. You want to provide walking distance for the people that are going to school.
They don't walk to high schools anymore, Mike. They're all bus these days. They drive their own cars.
But that's a factor of land use.
Is that because of where they're located?
But I'm thinking that we have the obligation to direct that kind of use away from high-density residential property.
From a professional planning perspective, I disagree. I think it's important that you provide an institution like that in an area where most people can walk to it.
So they don't have to get on the bus and feel like they're fixing a segregation problem.
You have to bring that into it.
Sorry.
That's not the issue.
That's how we become used to busing people all over the place.
I thought that, you know, that the only high school we have in our town happens to be on busy roads, but it wasn't always busy. Those roads weren't always busy, were they? But by putting the high school there, we've limited. But basically, it's Welsh and residential development. It's all sitting there. Ancient. There's no new residential homes around.
Well, the floodway. That's the limiting factor there.
There's a different reason.
And when I think about other zoning restrictions that we put in place in our business areas, we've tried to push business and more incompatible residential uses into those business zones. And to put a school in that same area, then you get a conflict with the businesses that we've said can go there. And so by allowing schools in residential zones where there aren't the conflicts makes it a little more flexible for the school district to try and plan and site a location. When they put it in a business zone, then we've got these other uses that we've said they're not compatible with residential areas. They're not compatible around schools, but they can go in this special business area. And so then you put that school there, where do the businesses go?
You know, when I think about middle school out by your neighborhood, why in the world did they go to the far ends of the town and put that school right up there?
It's where they had land. It's where they had land.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. That's where the land was. Now, part of our job is to plan for that. Zone land in a way that you're directing schools to go there, rather than say anywhere in town you put a school, put it. Zone the land where you direct where people who are going to high school and that's where they find the proper zone.
I think it's the school district to be tied into our city to understand the building permits that are generated and to say at some point when they reach this level they build a new school and they have certain lots available. That I was told. Whether or not they're going to develop them, I don't know.
Yeah. But you're going to have primary roads for all the school bus traffic, all the air traffic, already in place. You don't want to put a school that creates that. Then you have to sort of create the built environment around it. It should already be built. We'll be waiting for the school to come when it's needed.
I think, isn't it in your planning process, if you didn't, you had a rural street that...
You would have to upgrade the street to meet street levels of service standards.
For that impact. So it would be a little more costly to the school district to do something that was in a pure rural.
I can see a school going at Ewing's Farm, you know, take that farm out of there, put the school right smack dab in the middle of
it. Big FFA sign.
Well, 436.
So to the point of, I'm going to go back to your pervious surface question. Give me a school that doesn't have a big parking lot and a lot of driveway.
Mm-hmm.
No such thing, right? It's not just gravel driveway, it's a paved driveway with high gutters or high curbs and the whole nine yards. So if
even
we're allowing...
Even the football field's impervious these days.
No, almost, yeah. So if we're allowing it in one part of the code, but we're saying... impervious surface
actually
doesn't make sense.
That wouldn't apply in that circumstance. So those impervious surface standards apply to residential uses, but not to other uses.
Okay. So it is a disconnect that we're acknowledging. I'm caught between the same thing. It's kind of like, okay, if the low density residential doesn't allow it or does allow it, so should this constraint. And I don't imagine low density for anybody who lives in that environment imagines that they're going to have a school next door.
Right.
Or any number of business type activities, including Montessori, kindergarten, etc.
Yeah.
So they don't fit.
I moved into my house in 2003. Twin Falls was built in 2005-06. You think about, I live on a road to a national forest. You know, what is that supposed to be like when people drive down there and they're trying to connect with nature, but you have a school there? On the other side of that, isn't that a reflection of our community, is to be among nature and to see the wildlife that we have there? And maybe that's the perfect setting for the kids to appreciate it.
I don't think it was good planning.
So it sucked. You know what happened? I'll tell you a quick story. That land was designated by the county to become, I believe we talked about it, a halfway house, transitional housing, secure transitional housing. And the folks of Wood River and others said, not in my backyard. But the county had the land, and all about the same time the school district said, hey, we need to expand, we need a middle school. There we go. That's how it happened.
The second place they were looking was the property that the surf was on, the big sweeping curve on Ballarat. Is it Ballarat that goes up to the North Fork Road?
Yeah.
So my point being that was
their two choices. They chose that one because it was obviously a...
If that's the way a school happens, then, you know, it happens
without a plan.
I don't want to get into school.
Yeah, is that the planning commission's job or is that the school board's job?
So
or is that our job together?
I think that's our job.
You provide the zoning allowance for where schools are to have.
But then you're also dealing with existing landowners, and if we zone it in a certain area and we're telling them basically that you can only sell it to the school district, there goes competition. And now you have a disgruntled landowner who might have bought it to retire on. They're going to have to settle for this property because the school's coming in and saying, well, we can buy it for this, and this is what it's designated for. I agree. We need to think of these things in coordination with the school board as well as other interested parties. But I don't feel like the onus is completely on us.
But to keep to our discussion, should it be allowed in constrained residential or LDR? I'm advocating yes, because I think it does work in that zone. And what you're advocating is the same thing, if I'm correct, is that it gives the most flexibility for the owner to sell, but it also gives flexibility to the school district to find a suitable location.
I don't think it fits, but I'm going to default to allow it, and if the property owner says they don't want it, they don't have to have it. That's kind of where I am.
Yeah.
Well, okay, you're talking schools, you're talking sewer systems, you're talking drainage issues. you're not going to have the infrastructure waiting for the school to come. You have all those homes out there on septic, their own septics, whatever, with the sewer system going right by their front door.
But we're saying they can do it if they can figure it out.
Yeah. Let's see. They can do it in EP1 and EP2, and the sewer runs right out to that gray part out by Trucktown. They could build a high school there.
Yep.
Nice. What about churches? Because those are in the same area.
Yep. Church, yeah. EP1 and EP2.
I mean, as far as...
EP1 is church.
The CLDR.
In terms of impacts, traffic is really the only impact that you have from a church. It's otherwise a pretty benign neighbor.
And it's one day a week?
One day a week.
Yeah. It's not residential. It's not, there's no dwelling units there. I don't know. I guess as far as it's weird for me, but... Maybe I'm just probably getting used to the zoning and the way things work, but no one is living there. It's kind of like a business, but it's not. You know, it's just
think about a traditional small town that had the church and then it built homes out from there and had some businesses on one side. It was kind of a mix of uses all in one area. And so this kind of speaks to that in a way, but it also gives you flexibility.
Churches do more than just attend to the peripheral on Sundays. They do things during the work. They take a lot of dumpsters. They take in elderly people for lunches, things like that. They do a lot of
weddings and baptisms.
Work. Yeah, they do a lot of things for them. We don't really see a lot of.
But they're not high.
Yoga frisbee hurts kind of.
The only point that I guess would be a concern for me is to think about the homeless camps that many churches adopt, and to bring that into a sense of residential area might not be a compatible use.
Is that a zoning issue though, or is that more of a...
That would be a use permit.
It's a special use permit, yes.
But it would be something that, you know, there would be an advocate for.
I think it would be a little bit, elitist to suggest that that type of use could go in one type of neighborhood, but not a low-density neighborhood.
I like church I like to see churches in neighborhoods. I see a lot of that in Snow Hall. I mean, you go over our town, they have churches scattered all over the place. You might go over there and you walk up on them. It's kind of nice. Gives that community feeling.
But you don't like that for schools? But you don't like that for schools?
Churches in the smaller than schools. I'm not talking about elementary schools. I think elementary schools are exactly what you need in the neighborhoods. But the bigger the school is, the more withdrawn from the neighborhood they need to be. It's safer for everybody else. You get kids get out of school, they're getting in their cars, taking off to get home, they're not looking where they're going. They need broader streets, they need more controlled intersections. And that doesn't describe a quiet neighborhood.
What about a church that has 30,000 members?
What? Church?
Sunday morning. 25 or 30,000 people show up.
We have a population of 6,400. Where are you
going? Right outside 90.
Build a glass house and they will come.
I mean, there's a couple that are going that direction. There's one in Woodinville, Bothell. Somewhere right in there.
I say that'd be a miracle. Praise the Lord.
Planning Commission, it is approaching 9:30, and we have passed our 9 o'clock time.
Thank you, for timekeeper.
I thank you all for your thorough discussions. Are there any final points or questions or asks of staff? Any changes that you want to make sure we get in before the public hearing that we haven't already discussed?
I think a recap of the changes we've just formalized would be good.
Okay. So if we start, we made changes in our table. And on page 1, there were no changes. On page 2, no changes. On page 3, we struck 1.32B, Child Daycare Center, from CLDR.
Which one?
1.32B, Child Daycare Center. Did we want a P under Homes for the Elderly? Dick, you talked about that.
You're talking about adult family homes. So I think that...
Not adult family homes, but homes for the elderly and related. I thought you were talking about...
1. What?
1.33.
No, adult family homes, by definition, is not a Red Oak. It's a residential house that's housing two or three elderly people for respite care.
Less than 6 bedrooms?
1.31.
Yeah,
1.31.
So,
yeah, adding a P to that.
Okay.
We should add a P to that.
And we're leaving 1.33. No group home.
Homes for the elderly and related. That is a harbor group oak facility. That is it. So, in fact, they need to be near. Such services more than
you need to have the walkability and transit options. Got it. All right, so I am moving on. And on page 16, we put a P under 4.10, open space, park, trail, and recreation for CLDR. And did we remove athletic fields?
Yep.
And we struck the P and athletic field sports facilities.
Bring the time for the slow guy.
Page 16, 4.1, pretty is struck.
Yeah, got it.
And 4.1 is added.
What's
that? 4.10, which is open space.
Open space.
Is a P.
And those are the changes which I have made. Anybody any different? All right.
I didn't see your
impervious surface went from 55 to
55.
It's 55.
Thank you.
Yes.
You got that.
Yeah. Because I was advocating for lower.
I was advocating to keep it 65, consistent with the other.
Yeah.
Did we get to consensus on that, or did we just go, well, we're not going to take it to 45, we'll leave it at 455?
I got to buy it. I was buying in on the 55. But I do think that when you're thinking about what's going to happen, people would want to use that larger lot would be for outbuildings and things. Mm-hmm. That's the only reason they'd be looking for it.
And arguably, it's a larger space relative to the home site than low-density residential.
You know, the term horse acre comes to mind. Usually horse acre is like shy acre.
Right. But to use that land, like you're saying, to use that larger space, you need to drive to it. And then you're back into that percentage piece.
So, Mike, why can't we separate 45% main structure, 20% additional dwelling units?
We want to apply this the same as we apply the rest of the zone. So... I wouldn't want to get into other amendments that, again, would require a re-notification about what are we doing here.
I don't know if that would be necessary. I'm just saying, why can't we just say instead of 55%, yeah, instead of 55%, write it as 45 and 20% additional dwelling or additional units or structures.
You could, but from a regulatory standpoint, the simpler, the better. Just from the amount of time that we need to spend on things. That's from my perspective. If you're trying to achieve something very specific, you could write specific regulations.
I'm trying to get a handle on a 6,000 square foot main floor and a 5,500 secondary floor home and affordability.
What floor? How did that get in there? Affordability.
Oh, it's not.
None of this is affordable.
Yeah, I'm trying to get to that point. Is that our need for other types of housing and this type of housing are pretty apparent. And to make these areas that are great for growing families with kids to run around and rural wants, but not elitist that can come in and outprice all of that.
So you should have allowed four houses per lot then?
No, I'm saying big lots, but not extravagant mansions.
You'll get extravagant mansions.
That's the market. I guess you said they're from the Highlands, that's the Uplands, where you can have those mansions.
Well, why would I build in the Uplands when I can live in the city if it would that same house?
Anywhere in this market at that lot size, you're going to get extravagant mansions.
Yeah. Well, that's where I think as a planning commission, we can control a little bit of that. And why I'm focused on square footage is because if all of our homes, when we did the analysis, it was something around, was it 2,300 or 2,400 square foot homes, less the garage, without the garage, when we were looking at lot size. To think about an 11,000 square foot home on that property is concerning. I don't think that.
So to you or the owner of the land?
To the one that might have to buy it. I'd love a bigger lot. I'd love to have two lots, so I could have a horse, as well as some green space to relax in. But to think about what the builder might build on there, you know, how do we ensure some level of affordability that
you're not.
We're not talking NFL salaries.
You can't do that on a beachfront property. On beachfront, pardon me, waterfront, riverfront, protected space beyond. That land's not going to be, unless we go to high density.
The kind of stuff you get comes in the code when you say inclusively. You're not going to. You have to be in character with the neighborhood. So what's the word you use, Mike?
Context. Mm-hmm. Contextual.
Well, when you have an established community and new people come in building,
continuity.
They have to be. The code requires them to stay within.
Character.
The character of the community, whatever. You're not going to build four stories high or two stories high total glass house when you've got all these smaller homes around. There's something that
I'm not talking about, I'm just talking about price to square foot. I'm not talking about design and features. I'm talking about square foot.
Well, back we were careless and are talking about some edifice going up is not uniform to the community, that would be it would be out of character of the neighborhood. And that would the permitting the planning process wouldn't allow for that. That plan wouldn't get
passed. I love your argument and I appreciate that. But then I look at Wood River and I look at what went in behind it. And to Wood River residents, it's not the same form, fit, function as what they have. But it went in. So my argument or my question is...
to get back to your neighborhood, I haven't seen it for a while.
I don't live in Wood River. I live on the other side, down Middle Fork.
Oh, yeah.
But is it Tanner? No, what's behind Wood River?
Tanner Wood?
No, not Tanner Wood. Miner's Ridge.
Miner's Ridge. That's what it's called. Thank you. I always think of Tannerwood.
There too, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's on the other side of. Well, it's kind of on the other side of Wood River. Anyway, if it's not a shared concern, I drop my argument. I'm just saying that.
Can I add to your concern? So if you go down, and we could talk all night, I don't want to try to start that, but if you go down the road of trying to generate or allow for more, quote, affordable housing, the last thing you do is restrict land. Because every single layer of restriction you put on land makes the land more valuable and farther away for the developer to come in and build something inexpensive for somebody to buy. So I always hear this argument, I'm thinking, you can't put a control on land. You can't do it the other way around, which is common, which is the city or the development says, hey, we're going to force you, Mr. Developer, to put in X percentage of your units to be affordable. That's
the very biggest factor in the cost of a dwelling is the land. So the more land you require, the more expensive it's going to be.
So what Mike is saying and what you said when we were thinking about larger lots is that it's more expensive. And I get that argument because there's less people to pay for that stretch of street. There's less people to pay for that sewer line to be run out there, right? Instead of four, there's two, and whatever that times is and that distance run. But I don't get when I'm saying the difference in square footage of 9,000 versus 7,000.
So if you restrict what can be put on the land by pervious surface, by square footage calculations of the house, you've reduced the land value.
I disagree because I think about the cottage homes or what Miners Ridge, they were selling for $600,000. Same price in Wood River with a larger lot.
Well, you wouldn't be able to build Wood River today,
right,
though.
No. The lots would be have to be two houses on each of those lots, maybe three.
Well, I'm saying regardless of lot size, you would have a lot of other requirements that would drive up the costs a lot more to make Wood River not possible.
Right.
Sewers, sidewalks,
yep,
all sorts of other things.
Yep.
I don't know, you know, when...
I agree with what you're saying. I don't know.
You're shopping for sewers and sidewalks, or are you shopping for the house and the lot? I'm shopping for the house and the lot.
But some planners have said, no, we have to have sidewalks on both sides of the street, and we want you to hook up the sewer. You can't have a septic. So now that's a $1 million house instead of four little houses.
We don't control all the code.
Well, I know, but it's a concept, and maybe I'm barking around the room here, but
I agree with you.
I see it all the time, and it's like you think you're fixing something, but you're just making it worse. The whole concept.
Sorry, Scott, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I mean I drove by Miners Ridge once, and yeah, it just looked like from the velocity they maxed the house in entirety, and that's I don't know how you regulate that if you can. It's people are buying them. They're probably happy there. You know? They can see the river, probably. But yeah, it's not exactly. I don't know. There's rural around you. You don't own anything, but it's.
Is Wood River on the truck house side of the river, or is it on
the
upside? Yeah.
And just a point of reference on the map, Nick. This is Wood River right
yeah.
here.
Miners
Ridge.
Miners Ridge.
The right back side of it.
Yeah. I didn't
and then
that.
It's different. It's a different, and it's like I think the back side slopes down from what I remember. So I mean, literally there. I mean, if you think like Tannerwood, which I think Tannerwood's kind of max in a very little yard,
yeah.
But this Miners Ridge is even worse.
Is it?
And Scott, to your point, side yard setbacks, front setbacks, and backyard setbacks, it's all on this table. And so they basically built to those standards with whatever, you know, variances they got. So
no variances, they just built to the standards.
So that's exactly, you know, when we review those standards, if you want to take a look at those. I got... In Cedar Falls, I got out in the street and was measuring the street in various places while we were talking about our street was just, you know, it's just interesting to see what it looks like in real life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mike, using Miners Ridge as the example, if those lots were 10% larger across the plat, I don't know what the calculation would be, but I'm guessing it would have been five fewer lots, maybe. Would you agree that each of the remaining houses would have been at a higher price?
That much more to make up the difference, yeah.
Right, and it's not just that. It's an exponential number because the carry cost to the permit
time is
still the same with smaller number of lots.
Yeah.
So the $600,000 house.
At some point, the developer says, this just doesn't pencil.
Right.
And it sits.
Yeah.
So I get that argument, and I agree 100%. What I'm differing on is the level of square footage. So,
and I'm sorry. One more point. If we do anything to to restrict land use, it will always, in my opinion, come at the expense of the cost to use it. And whatever the ended use is, doesn't matter. But we put some layer of restriction on it, it's going to create more expense to whatever the use is. If your objective, the big picture is, and we'll come back to this, I hope, if the real objective is to create affordable housing inside the city limits, we need to be focusing on the business zones.
Yeah.
And the places where people can get quickly back and forth from their work location to the place they can afford to live.
I am talking about $1 million versus $5 million affordability. That's where I'm trying to be more realistic, right? If you're looking, and we can talk about this later, but I think the Uplands is a good example where you see some 3,000, 4,000, what's some of the square footage up there?
3, 4, you're talking like 10, 11.
Yeah.
There's, I think the larger one's closer to 13,000.
Yeah, pretty obscene.
So, clearly I live in a different...
You don't want their tax bill, my friend.
No. Okay. So, I will go look at the Uplands.
You can't see much.
No, and on the zoning map, and I can go into the county assessor. Yeah. And
that's a whole different context, too.
Yeah, that would not happen inside any city, that concept. It just is not, I mean, you might do 3 or 4 or 5, maybe, but you're not going to do, and it's 1,000 acres.
You know, if we're trying to say what the maximum houses are per acre, and we're saying 2, and at some point, with somebody at 1 per 5 acre, right? So we've gotten to 4 per acre, whatever the mix is.
So here's another example. Downtown Seattle, go back 10, maybe 15 years ago. The city planners were all using the certain amount per city block. And the company name was Smith, the real estate company. They'd been in the property management business forever. And they ended up owning basically a city block. And they ended up swapping parking lot, parking spaces, not just for a higher land use, but for a taller, skinnier building. So they created smaller spaces inside the building, but they got more units. It was a trade. The same thing applies. If you allow more use of a given piece of land, you can afford to have some savings for the individual dwellings. I'll shut up now.
Okay.
Yeah, those Uplands have a little story to them.
The warehouser story?
It's a little warehouse. Let's get our story. That was three sections. That was three segments of land.
Warehouse owned the ends.
Sorry. And the state owned the state of the center. The warehouse exchanged into the center, and we got this 900 acres, 900 just almost 1,000 acres up there. Right when the county was going to do the big land, the comprehensive plan review in the early 80s. But we had platted them for an acre. So we had 900 lots up there. It was going to be a boom. And all we did was we used that to leverage the county to accept the Snoqualmie Ridge project. We would just stop that 1 acre, that 1,000 units up there on that hillside. It was a total play to get the rich kicked in. But then that allowed Quadrant to come in there and put those in the tens. And the rest of history, there's some beautiful properties up there. Beautiful properties.
All right.
Call this thing Cowboy.
We should have with our city.
Thank you all for the thorough discussion. Mike, thank you for all the answers to our questions. Appreciate it very much. So the next meeting, we will have a public hearing on these. And anything new do you expect on our agenda? I know Jenna was thinking about what all the council...
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I can't think off the top of my head right now. It's too late.
No worries. Thank you very much. Motion to adjourn.
Move.
And a second. Motion by Mr. Lucky, second by Ms. Gildersleeve. All those in favor of adjourning, say aye.
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 We are adjourned at 9:48.
You know what I'm observing?